This little motivation for why this is something neat that I'm telling you. I'm very interested in computing spaces of modular forms, classical spaces of modular forms like this, mk, gamma 1 of n, here n is a positive integer, k is a positive integer as well. And by the way, this space breaks up as a direct sum of subspaces corresponding to the Dirichlet characters chi of conductor, or of modulus rather, n. Over chi is a Dirichlet character mod n, m, k, and chi. And I'd really like to compute these spaces. What I've explained to you so far is how to compute them in the case when n equals 1. Then the whole gamma 1 is just SL2z. This is just one factor. And you can compute these spaces using E4 and E6. You write down E4 and E6, and you generate a polynomial algebra using them, and it gives you each of these spaces for n equal to 1. So n equals 1, I've explained. You just do it completely explicit using E4 and E6. The next thing I explained to you was how to compute using modular symbols something about modular forms. Namely, I explained how to compute mk n chi. This is a direct sum of a cuspidal subspace, or decuspidal subspace, and the Eisenstein subspace. And just as a reminder, the cuspidal subspace is the subspace of modular forms, holomorphic functions on the upper half plane that transform in a certain way under gamma 1 of n, or gamma 0 of n. These are the ones that vanish at all of the cusps, those are the cusp forms. And this whole thing is a module under the action of the Peck operators, and it's a unique complementary submodule. This decomposition respects the action of T. And the complementary submodule is the Eisenstein subspace. So you can decompose modular forms like this. There's also something which I haven't mentioned at all yet in this class called the Petersen inner product. It's an inner product on mk and chi, and it allows you to decompose this as well. If you consider the cuspidal subspace, then the orthogonal complement is the Eisenstein subspace. But it's really not necessary to know about that, because this E can also be characterized as the largest T-stable complement of sk and chi. So what I told you about, level 1, I also told you how to compute this space in the case when k equals 2 and chi is the trivial character. K equals 2, by the trivial character, compute S2 gamma 0 of n. And you do that using modular symbols. And a quick recap is that there's these modular symbols, every single one of them can be written in terms of Manning symbols. You have the coset representatives for gamma 0 of n and SL2z, the images of 0 infinity under each of the coset representatives. That's a finite list of things, and they generate a space of modular symbols. And then you can recover this by taking, you take the upper left entry of the matrix of each Heck operator acted on the corresponding space of modular symbols, and that gives you a Q expansion of one element of this, and you do that for a whole bunch of different entries of the matrices of Heck operators, and that gives you a basis for this space. And there are more clever ways that involve finding eigenforms in the space of modular symbols. So that gives you S2 gamma 0 of n. In fact, almost exactly what I told you works for S2 gamma 1 of n, or even more generally, S2 n chi. You just modify ever so slightly things. The only thing you have to change if you want to compute modular forms for gamma 1 of n using modular symbols is you just replace gamma 0 of n everywhere by gamma 1 of n, and you find an explicit combinatorial description of the right cosets of gamma 1 of n in SL2z. So before, remember, the cosets of gamma 0 of n in SL2Z. These are in bijection with the elements of P1 and Z1 and Z. There's a similar description for the cosets of gamma 1 of n in SL2Z. And instead of taking pairs of integers CD modulo scalars, here you take pairs of integers and since k is 2, you just take pairs of integers modulo plus or minus 1. So there's a similar correspondence. I'm just going to write similar because I don't want to risk possibly saying something that isn't exactly right. Similar correspondence. And then you consider the, instead of the vector space whose basis is the set of elements of P1 and Z, you take the vector space on pair CD modulo plus or minus 1, and then there are a bunch of two-term and three-term relations exactly like before, and you quotient out, and again you get something that allows you to compute S2 gamma 1 of n. So in fact, you can also do something that works for any character, and this is actually nicely described in a paper of John Kamuna on modular symbols for gamma 1 of n. So there's a paper of Kamuna on this. Also, more generally, for SK and Chi, there is a notion of modular symbols of higher weight, which was formalized by Louis Morel, and it allows you to take these cases. Really, the algorithms, everything is almost identical to what I told you. The only difference is that higher weight modular symbols, they look a little different. Instead of considering pairs, formal linear combinations of pairs alpha beta, you take formal linear combinations of a polynomial, x to the I, y to the k minus 2 minus I, times alpha beta. So you take a homogeneous, well, a monomial of degree k minus 2 times a modular symbol. So you take all formal linear combinations of those. There's a relation, just like the homology relation here, but the relation is a little bit more complicated because it involves the action of 2x2 matrices on homogeneous polynomials. So there's, a description. And if you look at the plan for the course, I intend to spend a number of lectures on explaining higher weight modular symbols. These allow you to compute SK and Chi. So you can get this in general using higher weight modular symbols. There's a paper by Louis Morel in Springer Lecture Notes in Math 1585 that describes some of the theory and behind higher weight modular symbols, in particular how to compute actions of Heck operators on them. He also compares his modular symbols to some dual construction that's very complicated but really equivalent due to Shokharov, a Russian mathematician. Shokharov proved rationality results about special values of L functions using things that are similar to modular symbols. So Louis proves that his construction is, in some sense, isomorphic to Shokharov's construction. And if you look at Shokharov's paper, he gives a proof that his modular symbols really allow you to compute SK and Chi. It's this incredibly painful to look at algebraic topology proof. I gave it to an extremely bright student as a project to just try to understand what was going on, and he spent about a half of a year and gave up in frustration. It was pretty hard, so I won't say his name. But fortunately, Louis gives an explicit isomorphism between, it's not a canonical one, but at least he gives an isomorphism that's pretty easy to understand between higher weight modular symbols and something called Eichler-Shimura cohomology, which the details of why that gives you modular forms is explained in Shimura's book from the 70s. So you can believe that you're getting the right thing. Actually, there was a student, Gavir Bicep, who's one of the, I'm probably mispronouncing his last name, but he's going to be one of the speakers at the MSR workshop, but he did his thesis, and he claimed to have a nice, simple way to understand why these modular symbols have the properties that Louis claims in the article. But then I found a subtle error in his argument, and then he patched it up. But it's sort of really subtle understanding exactly why they work as they should. Anyways, I'll spend a lot of time on that. But that leaves EK and Chi.
And fortunately, there's really a simple formula that gives you a basis for EK and chi in all cases. So that's what I'll tell you today.
I learned about this first from Kevin Buzzard, kind of recreated it for himself and from Yaki's book on modular forms. And I think there was some confusion in the transmission coming to me, because when I implemented this in Magma, there were some subtle issues involving whether you use chi or chi bar in certain formulas, and it turned out they weren't quite right. And Dimitar Jetchev, an undergrad at Harvard, discovered while working at Microsoft during a summer internship that there was some subtle mistake in the description of EK and chi that was used in Magma that I got from Kevin. And we carefully read through Miyake's book and figured out how to get this a basis for this space using Miyake's modular forms book. And then we got something that was convincingly correct based on Miyake's modular forms book, plus all the formulas and consistency checks worked. And the reason Dimitar was curious about this was that he was doing a project with Henry Kahn, who's one of the MSR employees that I think involves stir packing. And it was really important to compute this Eisenstein subspace. So, without further ado, I'll just write down the formula. It's really simple. It's just a matter of getting it right. So here it is. There are a couple of annoying little special cases, but basically this is what you can do. So you have two primitive Dirichlet characters. Remember, primitive means that the modulus is the same as the conductor. And remember, the conductor is the smallest integer, so that the character factors through z mod dot integers. Okay? And by the way, the placement notes were right in the middle of page 83, formula 521. So let chi and psi be primitive Dirichlet characters. Of conductor, I think actually use L, okay. So conductor L, R, respectively. So chi is conductor L, and psi is conductor R. So chi is now to z mod L, z, and c. And psi is a map from z mod rz to c, such that when you stick it to the multiplicative group, you get a homomorphism of groups to c star. And on things that aren't in the multiplicative group of z mod lz, it's zero. So given two things like that and a weight k, you just explicitly write down the series ek chi psi of q. So it should sort of remind you of how you can explicitly write down a function attached to a weight, which is an Eisenstein series. This just involves two characters. And the function is, there's a C0 that I'll tell you about in a minute. It's the special value of a certain L function, but you can get it completely explicitly in terms of Bernoulli numbers, plus some m greater than or equal to 1, some n dividing m, psi of n, chi of m divided by n, times n to the k minus 1 times q to the n. And you can view this, and we'll view this as an element of q adjoin chi psi double brackets q. Chi psi double brackets q. So that's a completely explicit power series. And it just involves chi and psi in exactly this way. And there's a C0, which I should tell you about. C0 is equal to, there are two cases. So one, it's zero if L is greater than one. And it's minus, this I haven't defined yet actually, minus bk psi over 2k if L equals one. And this is a value of a Dirichlet L function, but you don't need to know that. But I mean, I will explain that later. So you have there a completely explicit Q expansion, and now the important thing is that
For most choices of k psi and chi, this is a modular form in ek and chi. It's even an eigenvector for all the Heck operators. And moreover, if you run through all the possible forms like this for a given k, and where psi and chi run over the possibilities of giving only to that space, and you also allow one extra thing, then you get a basis of eigenvectors for ek and chi. It's very, very explicit. I think I'm going to change this chi to an epsilon because I don't want it to be confused with that chi.
Actually, they did a hypothesis.
Okay, any questions so far? Yes? Okay,
good one.
Oops.
Yeah, I see.
Thanks. Okay, any questions? All right, so the two things that I haven't explained are, one, what is this? I didn't even define this. Two, when, for what values of k, chi, and psi, is this a modular form at all? And three, which ones of these do you have to consider in order to get a basis for this? I just said two things, but I guess there are three. So I'll explain answers to each of these questions. And just a little more motivation. Keep in mind that once I've explained this, the only thing that remains in order to be able to compute these spaces is knowing how to compute these when k is greater than 2. That's the only thing I want to explain to you. Once I explain that to you, then I can tell you some applications of computing with modular forms. And by the way, this whole theory of I'm writing down explicit Eisenstein series, computing with modular symbols, etc., it's not just for computation. Be really useful for proving theorems. For example, the week Morel had an extremely good understanding of modular symbols from work on his thesis, and then he used some of his ideas about modular symbols to prove, combined with some other results, very deep results, to prove the uniform boundedness conjecture, which is the following amazing theorem. So it's a theorem of Mazur that an elliptic curve over Q has at most 16 torsion points, which is a finite list of possible torsion subgroups on an elliptic curve defined over Q. So a natural question is, what if you fix your favorite number field and consider every elliptic curve over that number field? Is there only a finite list of possible torsion subgroups? You would suspect so, because in fact, for any choice of the torsion subgroup, there's a curve that's a moduli space for elliptic curves with that torsion subgroup. And for sufficiently complicated torsion subgroups, that curve will be a genus bigger than 1, and kind of expect after a while, maybe you'll have no interesting rational points on that curve. And amazingly, what Luis proved was that all you have to do is fix a degree of a number field, so d, then if you look at all possible number fields of degree less than or equal to d, then there's just a finite list of torsion subgroups that appear as the torsion subgroups of elliptic curves. So for example, if you consider all number fields of degree up to 2006, there's some number, I have no idea what it is, but there's some number of different torsion subgroups of elliptic curves that occur.
That's a very, very nice theorem. But certainly his deep understanding of modular symbols played a role in him proving this theorem. And actually, last week I saw him speak in Berkeley about, he came up with a formula to use an elliptic curve for LE2. Usually you consider LE1, but for LE2, in terms of other L functions that basically is the sum of other special values of L functions. But the really exciting thing about this formula is that LE2, just from the definition involving the Euler product, you can view this as product over P, 1 over 1 minus AP, P to the minus 2, is P to the 1 minus 2. You can easily see from the bound on the size of AP that this is greater than 0. And that means that one of the other things appearing in the sum over here has to be non-zero. So he proves a new, amazing non-vanishing result for twists of specialized L functions just by relating these two. And the actual way he goes about relating these two really has a very much a modular symbols feel about it. So, okay, just a little advertisement. And for Ralph, the fists of special values here are by characters of, they're just functions L, E, chi, 1, where chi runs over characters of conductor, I mean of modulus dividing the conductor E. Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
And the coefficients?
They're just these incredibly complicated things, but it doesn't matter if all of these were zero, then this sum would be zero, which would be a contradiction. So one of these is non-zero. It's pretty neat. It tells you there has to be some twist of conductor or a modulus dividing the conductor of the curve for which the special value is non-zero. It's really a totally neat thing, I think. Okay, so to answer the other questions, first the definition of BK chi. What is BK chi? If it was psi, chi. Okay, this is simply a definition, and it's actually the very first page of the notes. And here it is. Oh, I use epsilon in the notes, but I'll use the same thing as in the notes, so it's no, BK epsilon, it's just a letter. So epsilon is a Dirichlet character of modulus n. It doesn't have to be primitive or anything. It's a Dirichlet character, and you define Bernoulli numbers attached to epsilon as follows. Sum a equals 1 to n minus 1 epsilon of a x e to the ax divided by e to the capital N x minus 1. This is, you can multiply it all out and you get a power series in x. And that defines, its coefficients define the Bernoulli numbers, which are sum k equals 0 to infinity b k epsilon x to the k over k factorial. So the definition looks very, very similar to the definition for the trivial character. The only thing is you have a sum over a whole bunch of different ones over all the values of the character. So that defines the generalized Bernoulli numbers. And if epsilon is a trivial character, then bk epsilon is just equal to bk, except there's an annoying special case, which is when k equals 1, that's not true. I think the sign is different. So B1 is equal to minus the usual Bernoulli number B1, which is, and it's also equal to half. So the sign's different. But otherwise, it just generalizes the definition from before. Only when, in case in which it doesn't, is B sub 1 epsilon, if you multiply everything out. Okay, so that's the definition, and that takes care of one question, which is, what is this? Regarding computing it, I've written down a lot in the note, a great deal in the notes, but I'll just try to summarize it in a paragraph of words. You could certainly compute this by simply writing out this power series, doing a bunch of arithmetic over a cyclotomic field, expanding it out, and then comparing coefficients. So certainly these BK epsilon are computable. There are two things that you can do that are potentially, or there are improvements on this. The first thing explained in this is a way to compute the BK epsilon without doing any arithmetic over cyclotomic fields. All the arithmetic you end up doing is over Q. And that's what's explained in algorithm 512. So, basically, you end up doing a similar amount of work as the work that you do to compute classical Bernoulli numbers using a series. And the key observation is basically you separate out this part, and so you compute this without the epsilon of A. See, that doesn't involve any complex numbers at all. This is just rational numbers. So you compute this, and then you take a linear combination that does involve the epsilons at the very end, comparing with
Well, I mean, basically, all the power series arithmetic, like the division and exponentiation, do that just over Q, and at the end you can write down the Bernoulli number. You still have to do a bunch of it, because you have to compute this for each A running between 1 and n minus 1. Okay, so that's described in detail as algorithm 512, and that's all I'll say about that. Then the new thing that I handed out today is about a generalization of the analytic algorithm that I mentioned much earlier in the course for computing Bernoulli numbers. So this is something that I gave as a student project, I guess last year at UCSC, to Kevin McGowan, and he basically wrote up the section that I handed out. And what he does is he used the relationship between BK psi and a special value of a twist, the zeta function, so a Dirichlet L function. And using that relationship, you can compute a numerical approximation to BN chi. So I don't think anyone has ever written this down before. I asked a bunch of people and nobody has thought to try that. So we wrote it all down. He has some bounds that you have to work out in order to do this in practice. He also dug up in the literature from various sources theorem 516, which gives an explicit bound on the denominator, gives a number so that you multiply bn or vk epsilon by that number, and the result is an algebraic integer, similar to the Clausen von Staudt congruence that I mentioned before, or Clausen's von Staudt theorem that I mentioned before. So you multiply this by an explicit integer, or sorry, by an explicit number, and the result is an algebraic integer. Then you can numerically approximate the algebraic integer to very high precision, following almost exactly the same method that I explained before. The only difference is really that in the Riemann zeta function, instead of having Euler product 1 over 1 minus p to the minus s, that's what you have with the Riemann zeta function. Instead, you have, consider a twist of the Riemann zeta function, which is L epsilon s, or s epsilon, which order I use in the notes, but this is product 1 over 1 minus epsilon of p to the minus s. And actually, the convergence is even better here than it is for the Riemann zeta function, because here you have this epsilon, which will basically affect the sign right here, and basically you're turning something that was sum 1 over n to the s into something that's an alternating series. So you're turning a series that converged, that it's an absolutely convergent series from this, but if you multiply this all out, you just end up getting sum epsilon of n over n to the minus s. And you know that, well, you're going to evaluate it at a huge value of s, like s equal to, I don't know, 100 or 1,000 or something. You know that it converges very quickly, because it converges absolutely very quickly, but actually this epsilon basically just gives you a sign so that it's going to converge even better than before, or at least as good as before. So again, you sort of have a similar method using a special value of this L function. You can compute numerically BK epsilon. One annoying thing, though, is the resulting thing you get is a numerical approximation to an algebraic integer. And what are you going to do with that? You have an algebraic integer defined over a field of degree 19, and you know it numerically. You know that it's to very high precision, 1.27735582, etc. How do you get the algebraic integer? And the current strategy that we have tried for this is to simply compute the Bernoulli number to high precision, or at least the algebraic integer, which is d times the Bernoulli number, where d is this denominator that you get from the theorem. You compute this algebraic integer to high precision, and then you also compute its Galois conjugates to just as high of precision using the same method. And you use the fact that the Galois conjugate, if sigma is an automorphism in the Galois group of Q bar over Q, then bk epsilon is equal to sigma pi to bk epsilon is b sub k sigma of epsilon. You can see this easily from the definition. Just apply sigma to both sides of this. So you use that, you compute each of the conjugates, and then you construct the polynomial x minus each of these numerical approximations to conjugates. And that will be a polynomial that is the characteristic polynomial of bk epsilon considered as an element of the field q adjoint epsilon. And it has to have integer coefficients. And you hopefully bound
your error enough so that you correctly find those integer coefficients just by truncating. It's my wife. So you bound the error by truncating the result, and then you get a polynomial with integer coefficients. And one of the roots of that polynomial is vk epsilon. So you're basically done. At this point, you might compute all the roots and then figure out which one numerically is closest to the numerical approximation to dbk epsilon that you found, and that allows you to recover dbk epsilon. It's kind of a complicated process, but a case of extreme interest is when epsilon is a quadratic character, and then this algebraic integer is a regular integer, so really there's nothing really complicated going on.
But anyways, there's an analytic method. We haven't implemented it really efficiently. We've implemented sort of a toy, we haven't implemented it really efficiently.
It does work, though. So you can compute these analytically. Okay, so I've given you the definition of bk epsilon. I've said some things about how to compute bk epsilon. And finally, I just need to say something about what condition, how do you use these to get modular forms? When are these modular forms? And that's theorem 521. So basically, it just tells you when you have an element of the space of modular form, space of Eisenstein series, or which space of Eisenstein series you have an element in. Okay, so this is a theorem. The reference is to scroll through Miyake's book. I don't know where he got it from, but just a lot of analysis. Pretty painful to look at, but
the upshot of everything is that
the power series, I'll say it precisely. Suppose you have t, positive integer, and you have characters chi and psi as before. And suppose that k is also a positive integer. You can get wave one also. And suppose you have this condition, chi of minus 1 times psi of minus 1 is equal to minus 1 to the k. And then, just reading this, I'm going to have a little clause at the end, but then ek chi psi of q to the t is in the Eisenstein subspace. I'll use the whole notation. I is k of level r l t. And the character epsilon is actually a quotient chi divided by psi. Except there's one case where this isn't true. Except if chi equals psi equals 1 and k equals 2. There's a funny thing. The weight two level 1 Eisenstein series, you can write it down, but it's not. If you write it down this way, you get something that's holomorphic, but unfortunately, it doesn't satisfy the modularity condition. You can also write down a slightly modified version that satisfies the modularity condition, but then it's not holomorphic. There is a p-adic weight to Eisenstein series, and computing it is of great interest. And I just wrote a paper with Barry Mazur and John Tate on how to compute it, but unfortunately, that's the one case you have to exclude. But this formula gives you an element in this space. And moreover, if you run through all possibilities that satisfy these conditions and give you an element in this space, they give you a basis. Basis of eigenvectors for the Heck operators. Very, very, very nice.
And completely explicit. And I describe an algorithm for running through all the possibilities to get a basis in page 84. Okay, and now I'm going to leave and let you do the evaluations. And you can read about more details in the notes. Are there any questions before I go? Yes?
I think you mean that A and B commute.
Diagonalizable.
and then and both A and B.
You're definitely right. I mean that they commute. Exercise 5.1, I mean that A and B commute. Otherwise, it's totally wrong.
Thank you.
Okay, so, I guess Robert. All right, so I'll see you guys later.